Hello and welcome to Network Europe. Coming up on the programme this week, as the race to become the next French president hots up, which of the candidates can address the burning issues?
The cost of life is very expensive. Everything, bread, cars, but wages is not so high.
So who can solve the problem?
Really? I don't know.
Also on the programme, EU politicians return from their Easter break to find a Europe that may look very different soon. Thousands of Iraqis flee the turmoil in their home country to the sanctuary of Sweden, but are they being welcomed with open arms? Campaigners and members of the public alike descend on Prague for an annual NGO meeting, and Polish composer Henryk Mikołaj Gorecki is on his way back into the limelight. All this, plus our latest quiz, still to come on Network Europe, this week coming to you from our studios in Bonn, Germany, with me, Rob Turner. We start our programme this week in Brussels, where the European Union's politicians have been enjoying their Easter break over the past few days. But the Europe they come back to will be taking on a very different shape soon. There's a real changing of the guard across the continent, with Gordon Brown chomping at the bit to take over from Tony Blair in the UK, and the very pressing matter of the French presidential elections taking place very soon. With the French having rejected the EU constitution last year, I asked our Brussels correspondent, Stephen Castle, if the European Union was anticipating a change of tact in Paris to come with the change at the top.
I don't think it's any exaggeration to say that we've been really waiting for this event for a very considerable time. There are two reasons for that. The first is that France, although it isn't the dominant power that it once was in the EU, remains a very, very important country right at the heart of the EU. And there's been something of a vacuum there with Jacques Chirac, the outgoing president, a bit of a lame duck. And the second point, which you alluded to, relates to the European Constitution. There were two countries that rejected the Constitution in referendums. And, of course, one of those countries was the Netherlands and the other of those countries was France.
You mentioned the outgoing president, Jacques Chirac, there. He was always steadfastly opposed to reform of the common agricultural policy. What attitude do his potential replacements have?
At the moment, around about 40% of EU spending is devoted to agriculture, to those subsidies of farmers. A host of countries want to reform that, and led notably by the UK. Now, France has been one of the main blocks on that. Interestingly, a couple of the contenders in the presidential elections, the two main contenders, Nicolas Sarkozy and Ségolène Royal, have come out in a much more emollient manner towards reform of the common agricultural policy. It's impossible to see them taking the same position, for example, as the UK. But it is conceivable that they, as part of the next generation of French leaders, might contemplate the sort of reform that Jacques Chirac, who really saw himself as a friend of the French farmer, who was a former agriculture minister, that he would simply never have countenanced.
Now, it does throw up some interesting future relationships, the potential outcome of the French presidential election. For example, the Franco-German alliance, which was for many years the real motor of the EU. I mean, how, for example, would Ségolène Royal get on with Angela Merkel? You know, then you'd have two very powerful female leaders. What would that combination be like?
Well, that's a very interesting question. And the answer, of course, is that we simply don't know. I think the view in most of the chancelleries around Europe is that Nicolas Sarkozy, while he has a reputation for being somewhat outspoken on occasion and a little bit unpredictable, at least he is a bit more of a known quantity. He's been a minister for a number of years. He's therefore done the rounds of the capitals. People generally know him. And in addition to that, his brand of politics is a little bit closer to that of the German Chancellor Angela Merkel. Of course, the other interesting question here is how either of these two contenders for the French presidential three contenders now for the French presidential title. We'll get on with the new prime minister in Britain, who everybody assumes very soon will be Gordon Brown.
Why? What effect do you think Gordon Brown would have? How do you think he would get on with Europe?
Well, again, this is a crucial question. Gordon Brown has a reputation as being something of a Eurosceptic. I think the main question which is going to reverberate around the EU is whether or not Gordon Brown will be obstructive towards the European Constitution and towards an attempt to revive it or replace it in some form with a slimmed-down treaty, a mini-treaty, as Monsieur Sarkozy would like to call it. And here, I think the central question is domestic politics, because let's not forget Gordon Brown has been desperate to become Prime Minister of Great Britain, not just for the last 10 years. In fact, since 1994, when he lost out to Tony Blair in a struggle to lead the Labour Party. So what he's not going to want to do is to have a big domestic political argument, a big argument with the Eurosceptic media in Britain ahead of a general election, which he hopes will re-elect him or give him a proper mandate as Prime Minister of Great Britain.
So it sounds like the European Union's politicians could come back from their Easter break to find a bit of a different looking European Union.
That's true. I think those French elections, to return to the point, are absolutely central. A lot of work has been on hold simply because, for example, on the Constitution, there's very little that can be done in terms of the nitty-gritty and the detail until you have a French president in place. And that means that once one of these contenders is installed in the Élysée, there will be an incredible picking up of the pace. The German presidency of the EU will really accelerate its work, and it will try in the intervening few weeks between the results of the French presidential elections and the end of the German presidency in June to try and get a deal to pave the way for rehabilitation, a revitalization of the European constitution.
Network Europe's Brussels correspondent Stephen Castle on the implications of the French presidential elections for the EU. And we should soon know the outcome of that campaign for the presidential election. The first round of voting is on April the 22nd. Opinion polls, for what they're worth, put the right-wing candidate Nicolas Sarkozy in the lead, followed by socialist Ségolène Royal, centre-right François Bayrou, and number four is the far-right contender Jean-Marie Le Pen. Surveys show that 40% of the electorate, 18 million voters, are still undecided. Working-class voters often leave it to the last stage of the campaign to make up their mind. Blue-collar workers account for a quarter of the electorate, so they will be the kingmakers, so to speak. And that's why all the candidates are going out of their way to seduce them. Radio France International's Nick Champour reports from Charleville-Mézières in the Champagne-Ardennes region in the northeast of France.
The cost of life is very expensive. Everything, bread, cars, but wages is not so high.
So who can solve the problem?
Really? I don't know. I don't know.
We have several cases of factories who closed, so I hope the new president will care for regions.
Everybody come in the Ardennes. Nicolas Sarkozy, Ségolène Royal, François Bayrou, Arlette Laguiller. Promises, only promises.
Indeed, all the main candidates have made the trip to Charleville-Mézières. It is the birthplace of poet Arthur Rimbaud, but over the past year it has become the symbol of whitewashed windows and high unemployment. Florence Turquier is a former employee of Thomas Jeannot, a company which used to manufacture car parts. The factory closed down last autumn, leaving 300 workers out of a job.
They were very angry because of the conditions in which the factory was closed. The factory had been bought 2 years before by a financial group from United States. And then instead of investing, they just drain all the money back to the United States and then deliberately closed the factory.
What kind of impact do you think this will have on the way that they'll vote?
Well, there might be some protest votes.
Even workers who have jobs are disgruntled. Last February, a 31-year-old father of two took his life. He used to work at the Charleville Peugeot foundry. One of his colleagues, trade unionist François Cozot, blames the plant's management and the free market ideology.
A couple of weeks before Frederick took his life, he told a colleague that he couldn't bear it anymore. They were giving him more and more work. The way the company works is entirely inspired by hardline free market ideologists. So, at the political level, the people who have always defended workers in the car industry are the far-left anti-free market candidates.
L'intérêt des ouvriers, hein, faut pas se voler la face, hein.
Ever since the referendum on the Maastricht Treaty in 1992, workers in France have been casting protest ballots, voting for the far left, staying at home on election day, or turning to the other end of the political spectrum, Jean-Marie Le Pen's National Front. Roland, a 61-year-old National Front card carrier, is sliding Le Pen leaflets in people's mailboxes in the small town of Ranvé. He is trying to persuade Julia, the town's florist, spelling out the classic anti-immigration National Front rhetoric.
The ones who annoy me are the ones who arrive and expect everything to be handed to them for free without having to do any work. To top it all, they don't even respect all laws. There are 186,000 illegal immigrants in France. We give them free accommodation, free breakfast in the morning, free doctors, free dentists, free everything. No wonder there is no money left in the coffers.
Jean-Marie Le Pen is in favor of what he calls national preference. In other words, jobs, housing, and social protection for French people first. He took everyone by surprise when he kicked socialist Lionel Jospin out of the presidential race 5 years ago. The fragmentation of the votes on the left is partly why Jospin did not make it. Socialists do not want to go through the experience again, so they're calling on people who normally vote for the far left to cast a useful ballot for Ségolène to make sure that the left is represented in the second round. Jean-Paul Le Doc is a teacher and is member of the local Socialist Party Bureau.
Things have changed. I mean, people know, they know the risk now. They don't want that to happen again. I mean, now.
Why? Was it a traumatic experience to vote for Jacques Chirac in order to block Le Pen for them?
Yes. For me, I mean, still now, I can't believe I voted for Jacques Chirac. I can't believe it. I mean, this time there is a woman who could become the first president of this country.
Ségolène Royal wants companies who decide to relocate their activity abroad to pay back the subsidies that they've received from the state. She has also promised to increase the minimum wage if elected. Meanwhile, Nicolas Sarkozy intends to revamp the 35-hour working week, quite thoroughly, actually. He wants to allow people to work more and earn more. His balance sheet as hardline interior minister has also impressed workers in the Ardennes. Henri Auroloo is retired. He will vote for Nicolas Sarkozy.
I am going to vote for Sarkozy because I believe that he has the skills to govern the country. We need someone who is firm and determined. Maybe not a dictator, but close to a dictator. Me, I like Sarkozy.
Nicolas Sarkozy is fishing for votes among Le Pen supporters, hence his hard stance on immigration. Actually, this has been the campaign's paradox. Unemployment and purchasing power are the top two concerns of French people, yet the campaign has centered around security and immigration issues. Charleville-Mézières, Nick Champeau, RFI.
You're listening to Network Europe, a co-production of Europe's leading international broadcasters. It's been 4 years since the fall of Saddam Hussein, but Iraq is still a far cry from the haven of Middle East peace and democracy once promised by the US-led coalition. More than 2 million Iraqis have fled the country in the hope of a better life elsewhere. And more than 80,000 Iraqi refugees have settled in Sweden, thanks to Stockholm's open asylum policy, an exception to the rule in Europe. But more and more Swedes say they're stretched to the limit, and this welcoming policy needs to change. For Network Europe, Radio Netherlands' Perro de Jong, has this report from Rosengart, a suburb of Malmö.
Fire trucks and an ambulance outside a tower block on the Ramelsweg, a street where nearly everyone is from Iraq. According to Bakir Ajlam from the local Center for Iraqi Culture, the fire department is a regular visitor to the Ramelsweg, because 12 Iraqis staying in a single small apartment is no exception here.
The most of the youth here, they don't have work. They living with their family, 12 persons in the same apartment. I think if everything been as it now, it will be a big problem in the future.
And yet they keep coming, because many Iraqis have friends or relatives in Rosengard. The Iraqi community here goes back to long before the war, when Malmö could already lay claim to being Sweden's most multicultural city, with nearly 150 different nationalities.
I actually have some Swedish friends who never ever been in Rosengard, and they're so afraid to go there.
22-year-old Anwar Ali lives on the Ramelsweg. She came here from Iraq a couple of years ago and is now a student at Malmö University. She says that, especially in the last 2 years, the climate has changed. Too many of the new arrivals can't find work or a place to sleep, and they're so tired or traumatized that they don't even try to integrate into Swedish society.
Some people make jokes about that you have to get a passport to get into Rosengard. I didn't wear a veil when I was in Iraq either, so I get, you know, this weird look from people. Well, you know, well, she's from Iraq, why she's like that? And they already have this kind of, you know, that Europe is very freaky continent, people can do whatever they want, and they see some Iraqi person, Iraqi woman, not wearing a veil, so they think, yeah, okay, she's trying to be Swedish.
Why are you continuing to live there? Because Malmö University is not exactly around the corner.
No, not really, but it's not easy to get an apartment. It took me 2 years, so I'm happy with what I got right now. I don't want to lose it.
Malmö's city council sounded the alarm recently, saying the government has to find ways of distributing the refugees more evenly, even if that means ditching Sweden's policy of allowing them to settle where they like. The Minister for Immigration and Asylum Issues is Tobias Billström.
It's not something new in history that people come together in communities based upon their ethnic origins. We Swedes behave exactly the same way when we go to Spain in our older days to retire. The big problem, however, occurs if that becomes a hinder for people to take a work, because employment forms the basis of your Swede, the image of a Swede. We work, we go up at 7 o'clock, we go away and work, and people have to accommodate to that if they are to live in Sweden properly. But people pay into the social insurance systems, which has always been the basis of the Swedish welfare, and thus also with the ability for us to show solidarity with other countries.
But this year, the number of new arrivals from Iraq is expected to be almost double the 9,000 who came to Sweden last year. And Minister Billström realizes that a better distribution within Sweden may not be sufficient. It's time, he believes, to ask other European countries to do their bit, a point he's raised with the UN refugee organization, the UNHCR. The UNHCR's regional representative for the Nordic countries is a Dutchman, Hans ten Veld.
The Swedish government follows UNHCR's guidelines and recommendations to give refugee status to people who are clearly in need of such. We would like to see other governments to follow that example. It's difficult to understand that the European countries would not be in a position to take a few thousand refugees if it would come to that.
For the refugees in Rosengard, it probably won't make any difference. Many of them expect to spend the rest of their lives here. They're trying to make the best of it, says Anwar Ali, and she believes that that's the best guarantee that the bleak predictions by the Swedish extreme right and by some media of riots and ethnic violence won't come true.
A lot of people who's coming here, they already know devastated, and they just want to start to their life again. And they know that Sweden is the only country that accepts refugees right now. So I don't think they want to ruin the situation here, not for themselves and not for the people who's actually trying to get here.
Iraqi refugee Anwar Ali from Malmö, ending that report by Perro de Jong. Dozens of non-government organisations from the Czech Republic and around the world gathered in Prague recently for an annual NGO market. The event included lectures and debates on everything from the role of civic society in post-communist countries to water shortages in the Middle East. The meeting was attended by activists and members of the public from all walks of life, as well as Radio Prague's Rob Cameron.
NGO activists mingle with members of the public at Prague's Tyršov Dům, one of the many splendid Baroque palaces that grace the city's Malá Strana quarter. This is the 8th annual NGO market in Prague, a meeting of minds for people in the non-profit world, and this year's event was well attended. It was the brainchild of Forum 2000, the organisation set up by former President Václav Havel and others. Coordinator Jana Nojparová told me more about the event.
NGO market has traditionally been an opportunity for Czech and foreign NGOs alike to come to one place and present to public their activities, their plans for futures, and attract both visitors, volunteers, and also sponsors.
One of the biggest organizations attending the NGO market was the Civic Society Development Foundation, a body which redistributes funds from EU and other programs. The organization's Alexandra McGee explained to me that the work of non-profit groups in post-communist societies was crucial.
The organizations are very much needed in this country because what state cannot provide, the services that the state cannot provide towards citizens, there is still this huge gap that can be only covered by NGOs. So I see them as mainly service providers, which still have their space in the society.
But it wasn't just Czech NGOs attending this year's event. Ling Xing Yi is from a Taiwanese organization campaigning to end the death penalty.
From our experience, regional and international networking is really help the movement in Taiwan to abolish the death penalty. That's why I'm here, because I want to meet the people from other countries and to let them know Taiwan's situation. And also we want to know the other countries' situation. Yes.
The role of non-profit organizations is perhaps more controversial in the Czech Republic than elsewhere. Civic activism has many critics here, and the most vocal is the country's president, Václav Klaus. He's frequently attacked the non-governmental sector, most recently claiming that NGOs were a danger to democracy. That's something rejected by the NGO market's coordinator, Jana Nojparová, who says that after government and business, the so-called third sector has a highly important role to play in society.
Everything has always been decided from the top. So if the president says or the parliament decides, but come on, people, like, we need really you to open up to the third sector and start like doing something.
Janina Pavna, ending that report by Rob Cameron. That sound of Polish composer Henryk Mikołaj Gorecki's third string quartet, played by the American Kronos Quartet, is something you might be hearing more often in the future. After a long period of silence, much of Gorecki's work, and that recording in particular, is being re-released, a chance for music lovers everywhere to rediscover his work. Michał Kubicki of Polish Radio's external service has been following the development of Gorecki's career for many years.
It was the third symphony, subtitled The Symphony of Sorrowful Songs, that made Gorecki world famous in the early 90s. Written in the late 70s, it remained obscure until a nonsuch recording that sold over 1 million copies, rose high on the pop charts, and was used on film soundtracks. Since that commercial success, Gorecki has written several choral works, but as one critic put it, nothing that sent to the world I'm Still Here. In actual fact, however, back in 1995, he composed a major piece, but it was only 10 years later that he sent the score to the Kronos Quartet, which commissioned the piece and for which it was written. It is the third quartet. The dedication reads, "To the Kronos Quartet, which has waited patiently for this quartet for so many years." Premiered in Poland at the end of 2005, It has just been released by Nonesuch. Adrian Thomas, a British musicologist and author of a study on Gorevsky, attended the work's first performance.
It's the longest of the three-string quartets. It's almost an hour, about 55 minutes, which makes it roughly the same length as the very famous Third Symphony. And like the Third Symphony, which is all slow music, the third-string quartet is mostly very slow. The middle of the five movements is a faster movement, but at the same time you have the feeling that it wants to be a slow movement. There's something about the atmosphere of this piece which is very reflective, very internalized, very deep, often very melancholic, and it was a mesmerizing performance. Everybody around me was just concentrating. The concentration was fantastic. They were thinking, they had their heads in their hands, almost as if they were praying. It was a really very memorable reaction.
The Kronos Quartet has played a great role in the promotion of Gorecki's music. For first violinist David Harrington, the contact with Gorecki, which goes back to the 1980s, and the first string quartet, Already It Is Dusk, is very important.
Henrik Gorecki is not one to want to kind of define his music or in any way control the way a listener would experience it. But I can say for me as a listener, that there's no piece in the entire string quartet repertoire. I would count Beethoven, Schubert, Bartok, Berg, anybody that you can think of. There is no piece like the third quartet. The third quartet takes me into the center of loss and even death. In another way, I believe that it kind of defines life as well.
Now 73, Henryk Mikołaj Górecki spends most of his time in his house in a beautiful village near the Tatra resort of Zakopane. The lovers of his music worldwide are waiting for his new pieces, hoping that their patience will not be tried too hard. I am Michał Kubicki in Warsaw for Network Europe.
And that's just about all we have time for this week on Network Europe. But before we go, here's a reminder of our April quiz question. It was 95 years ago this month that the famous ocean liner Titanic sank. Some 1,500 people died in the tragedy, which ranks as one of the worst maritime disasters in history. But 712 people did survive, and we'd like to know how many are still alive today. You can email your answer to us at contact@networkeurope.org or simply write to us the old-fashioned way to the European Desk, Deutsche Welle, Bonn, Germany. Of course, you can also check out our website at networkeurope.org. And that question again, how many Titanic survivors are still alive today? We've five prizes to give away and we'll announce the winners at the end of the month. Network Europe is a partnership of Radio Netherlands, Radio Sweden, Radio France International, Radio Romania, Radio Slovakia, Radio Slovenia, Radio Prague, Polish Radio External Services, Radio Bulgaria and Deutsche Welle. I'm Rob Turner. We'll be back next week. Thanks very much for listening.
Ton de solitude.
du grand libérateur. De n'importe quel pays, de n'importe quelle couleur. Quel pas vous maintenez, mais local pour mon
together.